You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
What makes a good life is human connection, and it's so easy to lose track of that in a fast-paced world, in an electronic and digital world. So, you know, kindness and courage, being willing to put one's own principles into action, both politically and often in confrontational ways when that's necessary, but also in our daily lives with the people around us and the creatures around us as well, because we share this planet with lots of other living things. I think it's that balancing of the harsh, the political, with the soft and the ecological that, to me at least, seems like the beginnings of living a good life.
That's the voice of Robert Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Robert Jensen about his newest book, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Robert takes us into a deep analysis of being realistic about the challenges ahead, while also talking about some effective strategies to produce social change. So stay tuned.
We're very privileged this evening to have with us Dr. Robert Jensen. He is the author of many books. His latest, Arguing for Our Lives, A User Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Very privileged to have you on our program. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Jensen.
Always great to be with you, Sylvia. Thanks.
Now, when we look at the world today, we see a world where it seems like there is an imbalance of power. You know, we look around and we look at an economic situation where the voices of people seem to be concentrated in creating and clamoring for a different alternative, and yet we see more and more of that suffering. So I wonder if we could begin perhaps by talking a little bit about how places perhaps are defined not just by power, but how the nuances of power create networks of concentrated, of distributing, of centralizing, and at times of invisibilizing voices of people. Perhaps.
Sure. You know, I think that's important to think about, you know, kind of where real power lies in the world. If we take that question seriously, it directs our attention not just to, you know, a particular corrupt politician or, you know, a greedy businessman. There are certainly lots of corrupt politicians and lots of greedy businessmen. But it makes us think about systems. And so we can think about where power lies economically. In the modern world, that requires an examination of capitalism. It leads pretty quickly to a recognition that whatever else one wants to say about capitalism, it's a system that concentrates wealth in the hands of a fairly small number of people. Now, the degree of that concentration, and hence the scale of inequality, will vary from time to time and place to place, and we can observe that at this particular moment in history, inequality within developed societies, especially places like the United States, are at an all-time high, and of course there's inequality on a worldwide scale. Now, what's important about that question is to recognize that it's not an aberration, it's not a mistake, the predictable consequences of capitalism. That's the kind of system capitalism is. So I always find it a bit amusing when mainstream commentators seem to be surprised by wealth inequality in capitalism, since that's the way the system has always operated. Well, that's where real power lies in the economy, and we can go forward from there.
When we think about the system, then, that reproduces more of the same economic processes, how do we then talk about those nuanced geographies of power? Because, you know, we are each participants in power. So I wonder if we can maybe differentiate the kinds of power, because there's the power with that you speak so beautifully in one of your books, All My Bones Shake, and you're talking about this different system that we can create when we work together, a power with versus a power over, the system that capitalism depends on, you know, the one that diminishes one's voices.
Well, there's two really important points that you've made. So let's go back to you used the phrase austerity. And of course, austerity is now a term that's being applied to a set of policies, usually cutting social services, cutting welfare, cutting really the flow of resources to ordinary people. Greece is the case right now where the powers that be, you know, the Eurozone, the European Central Bank, they're demanding austerity. And what that means is that one particular group of people in a society, in this case Greece, are going to bear the costs, and that's ordinary people, the working class, and poor people. Now, you mentioned that we're all kind of complicit in this, which means that I think we should distinguish between austerity, which is a harsh way of dealing with economics that penalizes the most vulnerable people, to distinguish between austerity and frugality. And I think frugality is a virtue. So living to learn frugally, learning to live with less, that's a good thing and shouldn't be confused with austerity. I think given the realities of our ecological situation, this is going to be a world that has to learn to live more frugally. Now, living more frugally should be applied across the board, not just to poor and working people, but to everybody. So I think it's good to start being clear about these kinds of terms. Austerity is a punitive term. Frugality is a virtue that we might want to talk more about. That's a way to think about how even when we are all implicated in this kind of system, we can think carefully about that. You also mentioned, you know, different notions of how to use the word power. In traditional terms, especially in traditional political science, power is basically defined as the ability to get somebody to do something they would otherwise not do. So I have power over you in that sense if I can make you do things you would otherwise not do. And in that case, power usually comes either from violence, the threat of violence, or some other method of coercion. That's a very corrosive idea about power, but as you pointed out, throughout history there's been another definition of power, and that's power as collaboration, what is often called power with instead of power over. And power with realizes that all of us are better off when we come together and use each other's talents collectively and collaboratively for the common good. So, you know, everywhere we look, there's a kind of common understanding of the world that usually reinforces concentrated wealth and power, usually to the detriment of the most vulnerable people. But there's another way to think about all of these things. And I think what you're really talking about is kind of re-engaging our political imagination so that we don't simply accept the way the dominant culture tells us we have to think, but in fact we start to imagine new ways to think about ourselves, to think about words like power, to think about, you know, what kind of world we want to live in.
I wanted to go farther with the this notion of frugality, because I think that often, as you point out, people mistake when a conservative government in Canada calls for austerity that they're being frugal, that they're somehow being judicious in how they spend money on behalf of citizens. What are the things that we should be paying attention when we use these words? You know, how do we see the differences, the nuances, you know, of frugality and austerity when, as you point out, one is a punitive form, the other one's, you know, a gift, I suppose, a virtue of sorts.
Right. So you're absolutely right. Austerity measures, austerity programs, austerity budgets. We hear in politics this term austerity applied to all of those things. And usually what austerity means, excuse me, in that context, is redirecting the resources of a society upward so that the wealthy, sometimes the middle class, or at least the top of the middle class and the wealthy, are guaranteed a steady flow of affluence, basically. And that in those kinds of austerity programs, the deprivation is borne by people on or near the bottom. So an austerity budget, an austerity program that a conservative government is going to talk about is simply a question of how do you take existing resources and push them one way, which is usually up. As you're pointing out, frugality, when it's practiced, you know, collectively and collaboratively, is a source of strength. If all of us can get by, let's say I'm using less energy, let's say that, you know, we could collectively come to agreement about ways to live that could reduce our energy consumption. The advertising agencies would want you to believe that that's a horrible result because, of course, advertising agencies make money when they help people sell you products which take a lot of energy to produce. But energy reduction, conservation, frugality is a source of strength because then we're less beholden to the energy companies. It requires less money to live. And all over the place you see people, in, I think so far in fairly small ways, but you see the beginnings of these frugality movements. In urban areas, people, you know, doing more urban gardening, people coming together to share in ways that, you know, previously nobody really thought about because there was so much affluence. So in that sense, the consequences of austerity in some ways are helping people rediscover the values and virtues of frugality. Now, I don't want to be naive about this, that, you know, if we all just get together and share, everything's going to be fine, because, of course, you know, nothing's ever that easy. But I think a lot of the real work of politics, in addition to activism and organizing, as we're typically used to talking about it, you know, getting out in the streets or pressuring politicians, all of that is part of politics, obviously. But there's another level in which we rebuild, or in some place strengthen existing communities around these virtues of collaboration and common ownership, with virtues like frugality guiding us, that's a profound political act as well, to build up those kind of community structures. And people are doing it all over the place. Obviously, in places that have never been affluent, these virtues have been practiced for a long time. So if you're talking about villages in India or, you know, communities that have never had access to all that energy, then it's a different story. But here in the West, in the industrial world, in the so-called developed world, a lot of us are having to learn for the first time what these kind of values and virtues are really about.
The way we see the world is the way we walk upon the world. You know, what we see, we respect. What is just abstract to us, you know, it becomes something that we don't recognize. So I think part of the journey, perhaps, is to recognize ourselves as not just apart from the ecological world that we live with, but being part of that ecosystem, that social, natural, economic, all of those systems that we create are of our own making. And, you know, we, with our participation, yep, also shape them. In your book, Arguing for Our Lives, you make an invitation and you ask the question, you know, who am I? And on an ecological level, what kinds of questions should we be asking, you know, in relation to this relational processes? Because each system communicates with the other. The economic informs the systems that we create to manage or to mine nature, if you would.
Yeah. Well, I think, first of all, I'd like to second the point you made, that we often talk about human beings and nature. We talk about society and nature as if somehow human beings are not part of the natural world, the material world. And you point out quite appropriately that we are not separate from nature. We are organisms living in ecosystems on a planet. We're part of that nature. We can distinguish between the human built. You know, we look at a city, we see a lot of things that were built by humans. We can recognize the difference between the human built and the natural. So, you know, a city block is not the same thing as a, you know, a wooded pond or something, but this idea that somehow we're outside of nature is very damaging, I think. You know, I have a new book coming out in the fall called Plain Radical, and it's to a large degree the story of a very close friend of mine who died recently, who did as good a job as anybody I know personally of walking in the world with that sensibility you're talking about. My friend, whose name was Jim Coplin, nobody knows him outside of his circle of friends, but he was a very influential person to a lot of us because he lived that awareness you're talking about, that ability to walk in the world being aware of what it means to be a human being in a larger living world. But he also had the very sharp political critique we've also been talking about. He was on the political left his whole life. He was the person from whom I first learned a kind of feminist analysis. He was involved in anti-racist struggles. He was anti-capitalist his whole life. So it's not an either-or. It's not either you cultivate a kind of mindfulness in the world and you're part of the ecosystem you're living in, or you're political. My friend Jim Coplin demonstrated just by living that you can do both. And in fact, he was always actively engaged in community organizing, arts organizations, political protest, at the same time that he was very careful about the way he walked through the world. And as you point out, we kind of make the world by the way we are in it. And he was a gardener, and he took very great pains to be careful about how he treated the world around him, both human and non-human. And, he was an old farm boy. He'd grown up in a rural area. He had roots in a different relationship to the natural world than somebody like me, who was younger, grew up in a city. And his story is important in part so that we don't lose the kind of wisdom that comes from people with those more varied experiences, just like we don't want to lose the wisdom that comes from other parts of the world. Sometimes all of us can fall prey to thinking we've got the answer. And one thing I really appreciated about my friend and wrote about in this book was how much I learned from him in paying attention to the ways he and I were very different, not just the ways he and I were the same or agreed about things.
I love that story. I love that you're writing about his story, because I think so often we have icons in society. You know, we see the iconized personality, and we attribute certain powers to that prestige that goes with it. But too often there are many legendary lives, you know, that really help us to see the world to new eyes, help us to walk in ways that are more generative, that are, inclusive and inviting. And I think that those stories are the ones that, unless we're willing to suspend judgment and open our eyes and consider new possibilities, we may miss them. And I guess the challenge and the invitation is both, to live mindfully, to be engaged, without losing sight, that it's not all an individual's problem. There are systems at play that create inequality, displacement, and cause people great suffering. It's not just changing your mindset and saying, I'm going to be happy and I'm not going to have bad thoughts. I mean, that can be helpful in some ways, I suppose. But until we all recognize that we need to create a system with justice, some people will have very difficult journeys, in this world. What I get from your books is an invitation to engage in every level of our life, emotionally, physically, spiritually, and politically, because we create those worlds as well. We're coming to the end of our interview, but I want to give you an opportunity to maybe talk a little bit about what then would a radically engaged citizenry, what do you hope or what do you aspire to ignite, incite, and, in people when they read your book, Being Radical?
Well, I think, to be honest, I'm not in a terribly optimistic place these days about the future of political struggle. People are engaging in it, and of course I endorse that. I have my own activities locally where I live. But I think one of the things that's really important these days, and in a sense it takes a lot of courage, is to recognize not only what is possible, and that tends to be what political organizers are always reminding us, another world is possible, radical change is possible, and people are always pointing to moments in history when such change happened, and that's all to the good, and that animates our struggle and reminds us that we're not the first people to face difficult odds. But I also think it takes a certain amount of courage to recognize not only what can be accomplished, but maybe what can't be. And here I think we have to bring together both the political and the ecological analysis. The fact is, the damage that the human species has done to the ecosphere, the way we have compromised the ability of the planet to sustain large-scale human life and other kind of life as well, is a serious matter. And the processes we've set in motion, primarily with the tapping of fossil fuels, obviously first coal, then oil and natural gas, have not only done a lot of damage, but set in motion forces that are not going to be easily turned. And so, you know, I think sometimes organizers who I have a lot of respect for are not really playing fair and not really being honest when they tell people things like, you know, we have an ability to have a world powered completely by renewable energy by 2050. You hear that statement a lot. I think that's absolutely ridiculous. First of all, I don't think it's biophysically possible. And second of all, if that were possible, it would be a much smaller population living a very different life. So in addition to saying we can live by renewables, we have to say, well, how many people can live by renewables and at what level of consumption? And that's a difficult story to tell because that involves stories about not only conserving energy here and there, but really a massive change to the way we live. It involves struggles with political and economic systems that are not going to give way to that kind of talk very easily. You know, I actually think that in a way the most uplifting stories to tell are the most depressing ones. And what I mean by that is that when you tell an uplifting story that people know is kind of fudging the truth a bit, if you give people false hope, I think people typically see through that. And telling stories that are honest about the struggles in front of us, ecological and social, I think in a way it validates people's own inner sense that, yes, things are tough and things are bad and they're worse than they've been, and there's no easy way out of it. And so it may sound a little counterintuitive, but I think some of the most hopeful people are the people who are confronting the worst of these possibilities and talking bluntly about them. So that's what I learned from my friend Jim Coplin. You have to face the worst of it if you're going to be successful in crafting a new way to live. And his life was an example of how that was possible. He always faced the worst of it. And to his last day on this planet at the age of 79, he never stopped caring about other people, caring about the Earth, and putting that into action, both politically and in his daily life. And that was why his story was so inspiring to me.
You are so beautiful. Thank you. In your book, you talk a little bit about, you know, the work of breaking out of denial, you know. And you said that it's more about specific actions and about the habits and virtues that we must cultivate. So I'll leave the last word to you to issue that invitation. What habits, what values must we cultivate at this moment to carry each other through the valley? Because we are in the valley, and you know, and when you're in hell, just keep moving.
Yeah. Well, I think we've sort of touched on them. So let's just go back and remember that we talked about the importance of kindness. I mean, that sounds a little sappy, but the importance of recognizing the humanity in other people. We also recognize that in and of itself isn't going to have a lot of effect unless we have the kind of courage of our convictions and are willing to act politically. So kindness and a kind of very fierce courage. And then these habits of living lightly, or at least as lightly as is possible wherever you are, the recognition that a good life doesn't merely come from consuming lots of goods, which is, of course, what the dominant culture wants us to believe, the recognition that, you know, really everybody understands, we just don't take very seriously sometimes, which is that what makes a good life is human connection. And it's so easy to lose track of that in a fast-paced world, in an electronic and digital world. So, you know, kindness and courage, being willing to put one's own principles into action, both politically and often in confrontational ways when that's necessary, but also in our daily lives with the people around us and the creatures around us as well, because we share this planet with lots of other living things. I think it's that balancing of the harsh, the political, with the soft and the ecological that, to me at least, seems like the beginnings of living a good life.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Dr. Robert Jensen. He's a professor. He teaches media, law, ethics, and politics at the University of Texas at Austin. He has many books. His latest book is Arguing for Our Lives, and your very, very latest. What is the name of your upcoming book?
New book is called Plain Radical, and it will be out in the fall.
Fantastic. For people who want to reach you and learn more about your books and how to access your books, where could they reach you?
All they have to do is put Robert Jensen into a search engine, and the first page that comes up will probably be mine, and there's contact information, articles online to read for free, information about the books, everything you need.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Great. Thank you for having me, Sylvia.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.